the work that is here with SAPO and the entity, hopefully in future we'll utilize it as a model of having been able to turn around an entity that is as worth. So this is the work that I've been doing, because without the board, there was a vacancy or the gap, and that's why that Ms. Sweta was appointed. And so from the auditing point of view and the finance, they've been assisting the entity to try and sort of clear some of the issues. And let me just, when I'm open to you, from the master's to, for me where I'm sitting is, and maybe the comfort, DM, is knowing the support that we met first time I got appointed and what I'm seeing here today. It gives a bit of relief, I must say, and I think I'll raise issues that I want to reflect later. I know some people will comment to say, but things are not yet there, but if you know where we got into, and I always make reference to a meeting that I don't want to wish to remember. It's one meeting we were sitting in the old assembly chamber, but I felt I'm about to lose my mind when we interacted with SAPO. Because it just didn't give any hope to a person that was sitting. And what you see today is quite a different SAPO. Because at that time, I mean, we interacted on a paper, and if that paper said to us, it's horrible, and three, that paper tends to look pretty much comforting. I think it's important. I'm one person that likes to acknowledge where they're wrong, so I'll reflect them, but where there's improvement and things are coming, you need to reflect them so that colleagues and the people that are working on can see that we do appreciate that work is being done. And I think that's important for me. It's really important, because we are not here just to harm. We are all in the interest of building a better South Africa and for all the citizens. But I think I'll come back to more detail. I just thought those remarks for me are important from a point of chair. As I'm saying that there's one meeting that even when I see parliamentary channel flagging, I switch off, because I don't want to remember that meeting. I didn't like the way I saw myself, nor what I was hearing in that meeting. So it's really something that it's a bit really, it's to reach where we are now, it's really comforting. Remember, I'm going to allow you to comment. I think let's take the same strategy we've been approaching other entities. Minimum five for the first round, and so that we have more time to allow them to respond, and then we come back. I'm going to ask to the team to note issues, members will speak on of them, so that you can note issues that relate to your area of work or which you know that you're going to be expected to respond to. And then once members are done, we'll ask you to respond, and then we'll take another follow-up round. And Jim, I'll give you, you just need to indicate, I think immediately maybe after members or later when you feel like, just indicate to me so that we can give you space to speak. I saw a couple of hands already, Honorable Dungeni, Honorable McKenzie, Honorable Siwela, Honorable Koza, Honorable Shin, Honorable Kier, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, my question, you go to page slide 10. You're talking about product pricing. Which criteria are you going to use for the pricing and customer focus? When you're talking about customer focus, are you catered to rural areas like when you are talking about customer focus, rural areas are catered, because it is the people who use the post office from time to time. Is the second question. The third one, the administration, I'm sure on the end of May, the administrator is resigning. How are the staffers going to move forward? From slide 16 and 17, can we have 10 frames for your objective? The last one. What has happened to the old building? Are you renting out or are you still keeping it? Thank you.
I think when I remember meant that the term of appointment of the administrator, not that you resign. Okay. Honourable Mackenzie?
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Only five. We've waited so long to have the SAPO come before this committee with something substantial, and I do echo the Chairperson's remarks. That was just an opening comment, Chairperson, that wasn't one of the five. Just a general comment, or any thought, this will be one. To go from a loss of $1.2 billion in 2014-2015 to a projected loss of $102 million in 2015-2016, and then to a net profit of almost $1.3 billion, a net profit, it's very hard to believe that you can do that kind of turnaround in this sort of time scale. The word I can think of is incredible. So I don't believe it. Please tell me, what makes you think that you are able to achieve that sort of, in 3 years to reverse a loss of $1.2 billion and make it a profit of $1.3 billion? In 3 years, it just seems absolutely unrealistic to me. That was my first comment. We've seen in the presentation that mail is the core business of SAPO. That in fact mail is still profitable within SAPO. So you said in your presentation. And yet we talk about staff numbers. Staff is certainly the biggest cost, as I can see on the income statement, and staff expenses. We talk about actually reducing that number, getting the number of staff down. But I see very little in the presentation as to how you are going to improve your efficiencies. And only through efficiencies are you going to retain customers and attract new customers and actually be competitive in the postal space. If you keep reducing staff and you don't replace it with some kind of automation, some kind of extra logistics, what sort of plans do you have in that area? How are you going to compensate for that loss of staff? And let me be specific. On a visit to the International Mail Center, it used to employ around 70 casual workers that were then dismissed after the industrial action and were not replaced. In that International Mail Center, there's a conveyor belt system that sits there and doesn't move. There's still a guy that physically gets out and hauls sacks of mails across the floor. Clearly there are automation systems in place, but they're not working. So if you could speak to that. Something that I find very incongruous is when the telecommunications companies come before this committee, we slate them regularly for the cost of communicators. One of the things that we bang on about in this committee and how we believe as a committee that the way to bring down these costs and the way to make them less expensive is to promote competition in the market. Yet when it comes to the South African Post Office, our attitude is completely different. We say we must protect your monopoly in the market. We must protect you against competition. And in fact, in the presentation, there's a reference made to unfair competition. What is that unfair competition, and what do you class as that? And what sort of regulation do you believe should be put in place to provide even more protection. And how long do you think it will change that regulation given the cycle? And you see, all the points I'm making speak to that turnaround from 1.2 billion loss to 1.3 billion profit in 3 years. I'm on four, Chairperson. Okay, my last one. In terms of the corporatization of Postbank, we've been hearing a lot about that for a long time. And let me quote from the report. Through commercial banks and finance companies that recently increased their focus on lower-income customers, there is a viable and important role for Postbank to play in offering affordable banking services that support SA citizens' need, compared to profit-driven objectives in commercial shareholder-driven enterprises. So, to my mind, if you don't have a profit-driven objective, then you have a loss-making objective. Now, I can see that Postbank is included in the overall figures that are put before us, and clearly they make the figures look a little bit better. What disappoints me, and I'll speak through you, Chairperson, Dr. Lushaba, what disappoints me about this is that I don't see any fresh thinking. I mean, if I look at Postbank and if I look at retail outlets and I say, okay, what would happen if we went to Capitec Bank? I use that as an example, by the way. I'm not a shareholder. Let me put it out there. I'm not a shareholder in any bank. If we went to Capitec Bank, for example, that's operating in that space, and said to them, here's a retail facility. Here's a bank that we have. What is this worth to you? Couldn't we then perhaps sell this bank to Capitec and the assets of this bank, use that money to recapitalize the post office, to create some sort of, that's one, when I talk about fresh thinking, I'm no accountant, I'm no mathematician, I'm no banker, but isn't there some sort of fresh approach that we could apply to the post to the post bank that would allow us to leverage that retail space that we have, create a secure income, and then focus on the core business of the South African post office, which is the delivery of mail. That is the core business. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Sue.
Chairperson, thank you for. I just want to speak to two issues. One, we understand that the term of the administrator is probably coming to an end very soon. And given that many institutions that are put on administration usually revert back to their own problems, what are the mechanisms put in place to ensure that the post office do not find itself in the same position as it was before the administration? And secondly, your turnaround is divided into phases. Phase one is stop the bleeding. My understanding is that when the administration came on board was actually to stop that, to correct that. Why do we have to continue with phase one? Could that mean that the administration period has not achieved its goals? Why do we still talk of stopping the bleeding? Your KP is on page 63. You, even the situation that we have just come out of it, you're speaking of keeping something like 0% effective, what was that again, achieve labor stability and effective labor hours. You're speaking of actually 0% loss of working hours. How are you going to achieve that? Is that not over ambitious? Because sometimes you come in the future and ask you, why do we have this thing happening, and yet you said you're going to, how are you going to get to that level? And on top of that, you're talking of rationalization, perhaps meaning that some staff may lose their jobs. Do you think that labor will lie low and allow you to retrench or release the workers and without doing anything about it? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Firstly, one would like to thank this very long presentation. Long as it is, it was informative. Thank it. But I'm just having two issues raised here. In the presentation, mention was made that the environment in the part of labor is stable. But on the other way, they say the morale is very low. You can't marry these two things. What are your plans? How are you going to assist us to be able to understand what it means if morale the other way is very low while the environment is very stable? Secondly, you indicated that the agreements with this labor have not been implemented, and they never mentioned why, what is the challenge that is leading unto that. How are we going to, what assistance do you need so that you'll be able to deal with such things that will be implemented? We don't know what are those arguments that have not been implemented? What informs them? Then lastly, on leadership instability versus your turnaround strategy, I think the turnaround strategy can only be correct if there is stability in leadership. What are your plans to make sure that there is stability in your leadership? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable Chief.
Thank you, Chairperson. When the post office was here in March, I think it was, as part of the update on the digital migration, it was said that post office would be part of the logistics rollout for the set-top boxes, and that would, over 3 years, contribute 929 million rand. I see absolutely no mention of that program here. Is it sort of hidden in the general mess of things? Because I hope that hasn't gone by the way. If you can just confirm or explain why, you know, this, I would think this is quite a good income stream. You haven't particularly mentioned it. Then we talk about the cabinet decision to commit increasing government business, or increasing government business from its current 30% up by 20%. I had a quick look through all the cabinet statements that go back to about November. I could find no mention of this. Can you explain, tell us when that decision was made, how it is going to be implemented? Is it going to be by regulation? Is it going to be by choice? Who would oversee it? Would it be the Department of Public Administration? How is it actually going to happen? And then I want to tie that in with your ICASA license, your protected market of the 1 kilogram sector. It seems to me that there's an ability to move to secure business that you've lost through inefficiencies or costs or whatever to the private sector. At the same time, when you catch that back, take it away from the private sector, and at the same time, where customers have gone outside of the ICASA regulation to actually send their business to someone else, you've got to use the heavy hand of the law to bring them back into line. Is this not a taxpayer bailout by stealth? Can you please explain, you know, how you know, this is uncompetitive behavior. Then we talk about critical to this turnaround plan is stable and productive staff from, you know, board level all the way down. Now, I know there are, having looked at the government gazette on your recruitment of board members, I'd like to know whether you're doing the selection of board and executive management internally, or whether you have outsourced it to an independent professional firm, and what are the criteria for that? Particularly for employing the operational staff, one hopes that all the CVs are being independently verified by a credible institution, that we actually committed to employing the best possible people irrespective of connections. Then there is absolutely no mention that I could see of the amount of money and time or any specific program that is being implemented to bring the staff along with the spin-around strategy. Now, we're looking at a huge change management here, hopefully, and there is no
indication that there's going to be special programs, special training, skills upgrade, what that's going to cost, even if the program exists, or is someone going to have to come along and, you know, like it or lump it. Then you also talk about a crime prevention plan. And that obviously, because there's been an awful lot of fraud in the post office. What, again, is there mention of any specific kind of program for this, or what it's going to cost, how you're going to get the staff buy-in on it? Because these are specific programs, because your key component in making this work are the people. You know, they've been battered. No one really wants to work for the post office because it doesn't look good on the CV. People have left, and those that are left have been battered by the strikes, by the, you know, uncertainty, all sorts of stuff. And there's nothing there to make them want to stay. If the crime prevention policy isn't thoroughly implemented, thought through, funded, you know, these people are just going to carry on as normal because, you know, there's, you know, no buy-in from them on this. You've heard of the ECS and ECNS licenses. How are you using this right now as an income generator? How do you plan to exploit that? And what would be your expected revenue from that that would enable you to contribute a percentage of your turnover to the Universal Service Access Fund? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would first of all like to say that I really believe that this is the first time that we feel more comfortable about what is foreseen. Over many years, we have identified some trends. And I mean, if we refer back to the suspension of the subsidy for universal service obligations, we already then said that amounts to actually an unfunded mandate. Because unless your universal service obligation is supported, that on the one hand you can operate on a profit basis in the more lucrative areas, but in the further afield, distance areas, and where you really need a footprint, because people don't have access to all sorts of other facilities of government, that is to be supported, and we questioned that in the past, and we said, and furthermore, at that chairperson, that's my first point that I'm making. We also queried the ostensible profit that was made on the back of Post Bank, and we said unless you separate that and really look at the bottom line, we're not making a profit. It is just appearing to be a profit. So I really want to say it's a very good plan on paper. Now the implementation starts. Just comment on the SWOT analysis. I have not seen where you've listed the weaknesses and sort of problems that you face. Also the fact that you have to compete in a market, and I think that is very necessary. It is important to also list that as one of the weaknesses, or not, as a threat. Chairperson, the second one was dealt with the automation systems. I mean, clearly it appears that we have technology that is outdated. That is really a serious weakness for an organization that is competing in the communication field. You cannot run without reliable systems and people who know how to operate them and update them and correctly feed in to those systems so that you can have a reliable tracking systems, etc. So, to what extent have you analyzed all your systems, and what would the necessary investment be in that field so that you get your automatic mail sort of systems operational again? What is it? Is it the equipment faulty? Is it just what is at the root of that? Certainly, Chairperson, I would like to know more about the universal service obligations. Clearly, in your documentation, you have stated that you are also engaging ICASA on that. And the whole notion of a point of presence in a radius of 3 kilometers, I really think is absolutely unrealistic. Our country simply cannot afford it. coupled with that, governments and bureaucracies by nature are operating in silos. If there could be a rationalization of office space where you in fact share an outlet somewhere with another government department, that would make good sense. Have you investigated that? Because if you have that facility, if you have special ground office somewhere and you can also operate from there, then it would be more realistic. But to what extent? Because that, and the fact that you're costing the USO is so important. Because otherwise, you are carrying the burden, and this is where I differ from my honourable colleague. I do believe that the SAPU has a developmental role to fulfill. Because in some areas you have overtrading where the money is. You have a lot of competition. But out there in the rural areas, that's where the people need a point of presence. So how are you going to balance that? Then, Chairperson, I would like to jump to reputation management. That is part of the communication plan. I think it's good that you've acknowledged the need for that, internal as well as external communication. I just want to make the point that ultimately it is issues such as security of parcels and mail, etc., that will make people trust the post office again. Also the reliability. Now, Chair, with great respect, but you will have to change your strap line, because the trust curve, on we deliver whatever it takes has run out. I'm sorry. For many months you did not deliver. So you will have to develop a catchy new phrase to restore confidence in your operations. And there you really need some thinking, but you will not restore the trust of the broad public, and you will not pull people back from competitors unless you actually earn your credibility again. So I just want to make that comment. And then I would like to know the slide, it was on my page, my slide 44. What is the bottom line? Borrowing and funding plan. Any institution, be it government or be it banks, etc., would like to know that you have far better control over your risk analysis and your risk management. Because one of the key issues would be what is going to pop up out of the woodworks. A long period, over a long period, self-risk governance was not what it should have been. What contracts have been entered into? Have you really, can I say, confirmed your grip on that aspect? Is there nothing coming out of the woodwork somewhere that's going to burden you with financial liabilities? And I think you need to explain to us what the position is. I know it's an old, it's a matter that dates back to 2004. That was in court last week. But how many more of those sort of unsavory relationships, or actually not really part of the mandate, the previous management enter into? And I'm talking about long, maybe 10 years ago. Can you please explain that? And also tell us, if you're going to go with your borrowing and funding plan, look at what I don't understand is a further request to increase borrowings by 1.25 billion has been lodged with the DGPF. That is apart from your overdraft facility, where you have already have a state guarantee. Please just explain the slide which builds up to a facility to be backed by state guarantee of 1.6, is this over and above the 250, 70 million already in place? And can you please just explain your funding and borrowing plan again? Because all of this, I mean, clearly money borrowed, it's interest bearing, and all of it is that factored into your plan where the Honourable McKenzie has said it's just about impossible it amounts to a miracle to change from a net, a profit loss to an absolute operating profit in 2 to 3 years. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. I think quite substantive issues and would definitely have some time to come back. Members, from my side first, I think as I started, just appreciate, I think it's one time where I would have to make reference to SupportStack and to other entities to be able to follow the trend, because honestly, it's quality work, but we are able to engage in supportive issues and not worry about small issues. But I think the major concern for me is how SAP has been able to integrate its work, even through the NDP, how they've been able to translate that. And what is going to be key going forward immediately after the appointment of the new board of both post office and post bank is the separation now. Because I think going forward we are going to expect separate strategic plans of both the post office and the post bank, so that we are able to deal with both the entities separately as per the acts that exist. So I thought, let me just flag that, because going forward that's what we expect, not the current way of integration, because if you look at the acts, the established separate entities. And that's why Olin McKenzie, for me, when we talk about the issues of post office, if you look at the issues and how post office has been doing, it has been stable. The post bank has been stable and has been able to do. I think the issue of corporatization is before tools, but now following up, making sure that corporatization happens, because it's now a recurring issue for corporatization and an investment of government money. But it's how post office as well positions itself in the market that you're talking about. But initial thinking of what post bank is supposed to do was to close the gap between those who are unable to access banking. And maybe when we have a detailed discussion around here on the issues of pricing, on the issues of accessibility, because for me, both post office and post bank, there are issues that they must be able to deal with. It's an issue of reliability, it's an issue of efficiency and accountability. So if the institution can be able to put itself within that as principles, because if you are reliable, if you are accountable, if you are efficient in how you do business, then you would be able to get a sustainable institution. But you need to get the basic right. I'm not sure if I had anyone from HR in post office. There's basic things that need to be done, especially from the level of HRM. Issues of standard operating procedures are critical. Issues of policies. You can't have an institution that employees are not clear what policies they have. Doctor, when we interacted with the employees of post office, these are part of the problem. And as we turn around, we've got to lay the foundation right. So this basic thing that we have, standard operating procedures in terms of if I decide to fire a person, these are the procedures. Simple things. But if every, because the conflict that you have with your unions is when there is a misunderstanding of what happens when and how. And I can tell you, post office employees are one of those that rise to me, so I read most of their communications to me. Where there'll be even a dispute on how an employee was dismissed. Because if there's that, just and you find union leaders, I mean a deputy president or a president of the union, but who's not following even the legislation. But to me, there is that there is lack of understanding what the features of the institution are. So that everybody knows, if I take a simple thing, if I take the van company car outside the time I'm allocated, therefore this shall happen. It's clear, it's communicated, everybody understands. But again, the issue of, and I think you've been able to do an analysis of what the challenges are. And the issue is going to be around how you implement and give confidence, but morale and confidence to the morale of staff and confidence to the public does not happen over time. We've got to see you doing things for us to be able to have confidence that indeed you are doing. Staff is going to have high morale if they are realizing that they are consequential management. And you've got to start back, and I think somebody raised the issue, right, within this process, management getting involved. Because you don't want a situation whereby when the team, intervention team pulls out, then everything falls apart. Because that's what my concern is, and my worry, and my panic mode is at. I would have been comfortable if at this stage we took in already we have a board. And then we know that the board is already on board, and that's a risk we are facing currently. The major risk for processes going forward is to have a turnaround strategy and start a corporate plan, but the future drivers of are not here. It's a huge risk. Because you're going to have a board, you're going to have a chairperson of the board that might think otherwise. So that's what I'm saying, for me, that's a huge risk that we are sitting where we are. So it's going to be important the people that we employ or we appoint into the board, the people that we employ in this vacancy. But I think the senior management vacancy needs to be filled with credible and qualified people. And I agree with the colleagues. You talk to people, they are already saying, no, not my reputation, I can't risk my reputation at businesses. And therefore, a different strategy to try and find the right people, either through engagement with DPSA or DBSA, project managers and all those things. Credible people who've been involved in turning around the institution and stabilizing institutions is going to be important. So it's very important. That's why I'm flagging this thing. The caliber of people that you appoint for me is going to be important. And I really appreciated the analysis, the situational analysis that has been done and the environmental scan that has been done, because it shows that you're really internalizing the issues and the position where post office is. And an opportunity exists for post office in South Africa compared to other countries, because you have majority of the people that are still in remote areas or rural areas, and in the presentation you see those are some of the type A model of post offices. And I do support the issue that there is a need to engage with the regulator on the USO, so that there's balance. The USO, when you have those obligations, I think the previous targets were very ambitious in terms of saying within 3 kilometers. I mean, realistically, it's not feasible, it's not viable, it's not, it can't run. Even if you are to approach it in a developmental context that you are to service and therefore will fund it, it's not realistic, it's not viable. And in some instances, you find in urban areas, for example, in certain, I think within a small radius, about 3 or 4 post offices. And majority of the time, those post offices are empty. That's why you would not find revenue out of them. So we've got to be able to say, what are the things that as we internalize, we do the same. Realistically now, analysis is that our market in terms of money, while international trends are that may is dropping, we have an opportunity to service unserved areas in terms of money that can still generate income. So it could take 2 to 3 years for post office in this country. Because you've got to analyze the penetration of internet. That's why you are in within the ICT sector. Because you've got to look for your internet or your mailing to drop is because people would have access to your internet and all those things. Now when you look at penetration level of internet in the country, you're sitting almost around 6 billion. So you have about 34 million, if I'm not mistaken, of the population that does not have access to internet. And this is your target that you must be able to service. So this is an analysis that post office should be able to do and say, how do we get, that's our target, that's our market. How do you access that market? Where is this market? When you look at it. So that's one thing within this analysis and your situation analysis is good that you're doing this. And I think on the issues of banks and all that, I've looked at it as something that we can have a discussion later, which I did not want to get myself into. Then you talk around the turnaround strategy. What I find intriguing, and I think for me it's discomforting, is your monitoring process that excludes the monitoring evaluation department. Or what seems like a duplication. You have a department established by government, which is the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. Then in your strategic plan or your corporate plan 20, page 27, you talk about the monitoring process, which is under trusting with National Treasury and TTPS. So if you are to have a monitoring process, for a turnaround strategy, if you're putting it until 2018, sustainable mechanism will be that the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation does the monitoring and evaluation, because in those departments, the establishment is that each area will have a specialty, a person that understands the sector, understands the issues. And unless it's through the minister, then there can be an additional request to say, because post office with its challenges, we therefore request additional capacity to be able to do the to deal with it. So for me, it's just that. But again, even with the PM, the group project management office, yes, the project management is there, but who are the people? Are they the right people to be there? The capacity and the skills they have. I'm raising this question because we don't want to go back to the 5 years back. We need to start seeing going forward as post office. So those things are important. But you will have a project management office, but it needs to have the right people to be able to do the right job. I've raised the issues of HR that I think needs to be dealt with, so that the devil is in the details in how you deal with your HR issues and stabilize post office. Now, just issues that I want to come to more as well, and I think I'll come back later when colleagues have responded, around the finances. That's why I said initially that the separation between strategic plan of post office and post bank is very clear. You look at the post, let me start with page 45. Your proposal, lastly, the last issue, your proposal in terms of structure, look at the group structure, which is sitting in page 58. You're referring to, okay, we've got those subsidiaries, but in your proposal going forward, you seem to have suggested one subsidiary, I'm not sure, I could be wrong, but maybe clarify. You seem to be suggested that one subsidiary goes, which is CFG, which I fully agree has been making a loss over time, and I'm not sure why post office, actually the previous board should have been held liable for this, because companies act very clear. But then there's how to pronounce it, Dozex and Property Company subsidiaries. They are relevant to processes and whether we need to proceed with them, if you can clarify that. Those are the comments I have. I think I'll come back later. My colleagues are saying that I'm abusing my powers as a chair. And I think I'm taking advantage not well at some point. I could have missed what they said. Basically, I'm feeling exhausted, but let's proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Should we respond? In order. Okay.
In any order, just to request that the questions be responded to, and I hope colleagues have noted. Normally, I have been noting. So, today, my concentration level is not very high. So, colleagues will pardon me. I should have taken the medication by the time.
Thank you very much. Maybe I've also this afternoon abused the administrator's role, so let me allow management to start first, because they also need to say, have their say, and take charge of this process. Andrea, maybe you want to start and then you tell us who follows. Just tell us which questions are you responding to so that we take them off. Thanks.
I will start with the questions that relate to human capital management, and I'll start with the one that refers specifically to the labour environment. And the types of agreements that we have with labour and what are the challenges with meeting those agreements. And in fact, we did a thorough analysis of what the agreements are with labour, and what came out was that a lot of the agreements we've implemented, but there were certain elements of those agreements that were not fully implemented, and those agreements that were not fully implemented really relate to the conversion of casuals through the different phases of agreements that have been reached with unions. What we have done in the interim is to actually have had discussions with the different trade unions around those agreements. We've not reached finality on those discussions, but it's ongoing discussions around how we can actually, whilst we reduce our staff numbers, not necessarily reduce the flexible or what was previously called casual labour as a result of this process, but that we look at what is the skills that we require in the future, and that we populate the organisation and the structure that we will develop through this process with the right skills. Now, obviously, as a corporate, as a responsible corporate citizen, what we also have to do is to make provisions for those people that we've had within in the organization, in the casual labor force, that, or what we now refer to as the flexible labor force, that we've not previously made permanent. So we're working on ways in which we can address that issue specifically. And there's a lot of agreement around the fact with labor that we need to address the overall staff numbers, and the way and there's agreement in terms of us getting to a negotiated settlement in terms of that. But as you can imagine, it's a balancing act at this point in terms of what is the funding that we have available within the organization. organization to actually deal with that, and how do we use the funding that we will get through our funding plan to not only deal with the labor issues, but at the same time also deal with our operational needs of the organization. So at this point, we're still negotiating with labor. We, both parties are very willing to get to an agreement, and there is a clear understanding that we will deal with this in a very responsible manner. Okay?
Maybe I'll just add to that, to say that one of the major reasons it was difficult to implement that was affordability. It would have costed us in excess of R1.5 billion over the next 3 years even to implement, but the agreement was to implement over the next 24 months. Mm. So the losses that we see forecasted today in our financials would have increased by another R1.5 billion in present value if we just went ahead and implemented. So we have to navigate a very fine balance in terms of what was promised and reality. However, the agreement, the last one that we signed on conversions, does accommodate affordability. We have said that we will implement based on affordability, and that's what we're actually working on in terms of ensuring that the company can afford and then implement. But as you would understand, if you are in a situation where you need to be converted, you want to be converted tomorrow because there are benefits, there's money involved, and then people run out of patience. And that's why we actually need to move with the turnaround, because it enables us to convert those that would remain in the system and that would be appointed. And I think that's been the pain in the system, that some of the promises, and they were made, I'm not criticizing it, but they were made out of pressure at the time, because people were trying to settle the situation. But the reality is money has to come from somewhere. There's a company that makes a loss of R1 billion, then you can't be responsible and just add another R1.5 billion and not do anything about it. Thanks.
Okay. If we go to the next question, which basically looked at change management, the morale of the employees, and I'm going to look at those questions together, because they actually look at the whole structure of human capital management within the organization. And we've done, once again, through the assistance of the intervention team, we've done a thorough analysis around what are the issues around low morale. And some of the issues around low morale is around not being able to see a vision for this organization. So part of this of the strategic turnaround plan is to actually enable people to see that this is an organization that, one, has a future, and two, that there is plans and that the plans are credible to get to the to this new future. And part of the another element is also in terms of the employee value proposition. Now, if you look at our remuneration policy and philosophy within the organization, unfortunately, because of the funding situation, especially at the management level of the organization, that has actually stayed behind in terms of market relatedness. And part of our enabling a new employee value proposition is to actually look at, one, having a market-related remuneration philosophy and also remuneration policy, but at the same time, tying that into attaining objectives and creating a high-performance culture within the organization. So what we're also looking at is to look at an incentive program, and we started looking and investigating that, but that should be tied into a very credible performance management system, and that's something that we've been working on in terms of ensuring that, one, the KPIs that we've identified within this document can be cascaded down to all the levels of the organization, and also to create a discipline around performance management. One of the things around within the post office is that the discipline around performance management has not been there. So one of the things that we've worked on, especially this last 3 months, is to get people to understand, one, that the performance management system should be at this stage divorced from the remuneration or the payment cycle, because it's not as stable as it should be. So the second part then is to enable that the discipline in the organization around performance management, and not just in terms of setting performance objectives, but also to have the tough conversations that enable consequence management to take place. Because it's worthless having a performance management system if you're going to rate everyone a 5 or whatever. So one of the critical things is that to enable line management to have the skills to have that performance management discussion. And another question that was raised was around what is the foundational skills, and in terms of SOPs and around what is it that we need to know within the organization. So within the learning and development space, we've also looked at where do we go back to ensure that at some point within the post office, people actually understood and knew exactly what they were supposed to do, and they also knew what the consequences was of not doing it. So it is to go back then to find out what exactly is it that we now have to roll out. Because remember, within the context of a changing organization, people will take a lot of chances. So what we need to do is to ensure that people are skilled, that we have, once again, programs that enable the staff to understand this is what the foundational SOPs are, this is what we need to do, and this is how we manage it as line management. So that is one of the key areas from a human capital management perspective that we're also focusing on. But beyond that, it is also around process efficiency, especially from an ER perspective. So one of the ways that we're working through this program is to specifically with the unions, we started the process of working with them in terms of the building workplace relationships. And now what we're doing is that we're furthering that. We've together with them developed a capability development program in terms of what is it that a line manager should know around ER processes, what is it that a shop team should know around ER processes, and how do we manage those processes. Because when I looked at a lot of the issues that came up, a lot of it was that people really did not understand what those processes are and how they should be applied. So part of addressing this issue is also to start ensuring that people have the right skills and that they apply those skills. Just within the last 6 months, we've investigated all of the ER cases to ensure that we make sure that there's not issues where people are, for instance, dismissed without the proper processes being followed. And there is some gaps in terms of that, and we're addressing that through this capability program that we're developing with the unions. Okay. I think, Andrew, if you can...
Sorry, Antia, maybe just let me also emphasize that there has been inconsistency on our side. In that some of the areas we were inconsistent as management. One of the things that is very difficult that we're dealing with is where you then find now that you're trying to take corrective action, people will conveniently point out, but June last year, this other group got away with it. You are actually now doing this because you are being harsh with us, whereas other people. So we need to break the errors and be very clear that whilst you've gotten away with this, you may have gotten away with this in the past, it is not going to happen going forward. Because we get a lot of that says, yeah, we understand why you're doing this, but it was not done September last year. It was not done at this point. For instance, I had an issue where people went on strike and somehow they came back. That was July last year to August, and the allegation is that they were paid for the time that they were on strike. They were paid the bonuses or incentives that were paid during that time or whatever, and therefore the day after they come back, another group went on strike, and unfortunately for them, when they stopped, things have changed. So now you draw a line and you say to them, we take disciplinary action, we don't pay for the days on strike, we don't phase in. There was a process that they alleged happened where the no work, no pay was phased in instead of taken at once. So we have a lot of that in terms of the inconsistencies also on our side as management, which has created confusion. And that's one of the areas that we're really trying very hard to communicate. Antia came in on the 5th of January, as she's very new.
as the general executive HR, and she doesn't know what she didn't know what she was walking in, but she's really up to it and trying very hard. But it's a matter of breaking from our own past. So I understand where some of the confusion comes from, because when you've seen other people getting away with it, then all of a sudden you've been dealt with on that basis, and therefore there's a need for us to consistently communicate that things have changed. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson and members of the committee. Let me try and deal with a few of the area questions. There was a question around the criteria for product pricing. Ideally, our criteria is around profitability and sustainability. In the past, the tendency was that we would price in such a manner that, in fact, in many cases, we were subsidizing the customer that we were trying to do business with. And clearly, that is unsustainable. However, it is important that a discussion we've been having is we've been talking about differentiated pricing. So, for example, where I deal with the Foshinis and the Honchos of this world, I then apply commercial market-related pricing. When I go into rural areas, I have to take a different tack. When I'm pricing for individual customers for services that are ordinarily utilized by individual customers, especially in rural areas, I need to look at a different type of pricing when I do that. So those are some of the discussions that we are looking at. Secondly, the question of customer focus. Are we focusing and catering for rural areas? Most definitely we are. I think as we've pointed out, we are fully cognizant of the fact that as an SOE, a key part of our role is to service people in rural areas. And consequently, when we do market, when we develop what we do develop, we must do so in the light of those communities. I would like to point out that, you know, one of the mistakes or where the mistakes that we made in the past was that there was an insistence in the past that when we develop our retail outlet, the retail outlet that you have in Santon, you must have it also in Tsala, for example, in the same form and shape. And again, the cost for that were unsustainable. So again, we have to think, which communities are we going in? What type of outlet do we provide for that community, which is sustainable for that community? So we will be definitely given a great deal of focus to rural communities, especially when we use mobile post offices, for example. Take into account the vast areas that have to be covered in rural areas and what is the best way to service rural communities in that respect. Taking into account, of course, things like financial inclusion, financial literacy from the post-bank side as well. What happens after the administrator leaves? We will continue, man. We will implement this plan. It's part of management's prerogative and willingness to actually do so. I'm sure you'll answer the question yourself a bit later on, but I took the chance to to just answer. But certainly, we are committed to the plan, and we will certainly implement it to the best of our ability. What is happening to NPC? As we stand at the moment, we are trying to ascertain to what extent we can get out of the current lease arrangement we have at EcoPoint. We're trying to understand what were the terms and conditions that were entered into and in what manner they were entered into. And if it should turn out that there was some, for lack of a better word, fraudulent activity entering into those agreements, then we will gladly break that lease agreement and return to the NPC. However, if it turns out that we are unable to do so, we already have a potential buyer for the NPC, so we do have both options. So that is the status of the NPC at the moment. Honorable Mackenzie, $1.3 billion in 3 years, net profit, highly ambitious. Ambitious, yes, I agree. Totally unrealistic, maybe not. I think there are a number of revenue upliftment initiatives that you will see there, and I admit a lot of it is backed by the requirement that we do get from government what is due to the post office.
I've put them up. Okay.
Oh, thank you. So some of them are up there. So we are fairly confident that if we pursue this and we manage to get what we require from government and other sources, indeed we will be able to meet that target. How will we improve efficiencies while we are reducing staff? And you did mention JMC in particular. The reality is that the post office has, for example, a great deal of machinery on the floor
for automatic sorting of mail. Currently we're using those machines up to 30% and no more. So in other words, we could utilize them a bit more efficiently and a bit more effectively. And that is the way to go. We are going to have to go that way. But even when we do have manual labor, we also have to look at how efficiently we utilize that manual labor. And Mr. McKenzie, this will also involve, for example, in the case of JMC, how we rotate our staff to fill in those positions where they are critically required, and we move from places where you have overstaffing, so to speak. So that is part of what we intend to do to ensure that whatever labor we do have in the post office is actually utilized very efficiently and very effectively. So, for example, you talk about the conveyor belt in Jersey. That conveyor belt, when it was put in there, it was put in at a period where there was very low volumes. And so I think when you went there, you would have seen that at the entrance, there's so much volumes now coming in that utilizing the conveyor belt doesn't help you, because all it does is it dumps it on the other side and you can't get access. So we actually took a decision to stop it for now while we try and figure out how we clear out that area and accommodate for more people to come in and assist in making sure that we actually have a much more efficient operation at JMC. So as we speak right now, we have a number of initiatives that have been implemented at JMC to try and ensure that we are a bit more effective in that area. And I do take the view, of course, that as you quite rightly put it, Ms. Killen, that you will only get our customers back if we can prove that we are reliable, we are secure, and then we are efficient in what we do.
Also, can I also add, so that we just finish the question, we also have a history of having worked in isolation of the rest of the value chain in which we participate. So for instance, I made an example with the mail to Nelspruit. It gets printed here, bulk of it by very large printing entities like Bidvest Data. We have not worked with them, one, to reduce our handling of the mail, but also we could have and want to work better with them in partnership, so that when they invest, they actually invest in areas that are closer to where the mail is going for printing, because that mail was digitized at some point. We're also going to increase our hybrid mail offering, where we actually get data ourselves at the post office, and we already do this with municipalities, and we print it for them as close as possible to where the mail is going. So it's going to be part of the automation process. However, in our plan, we have not suggested that the post office should invest all the capital. We suggested that the post office should work in partnership with people already in that business of printing to actually leverage that capacity, but in a manner that reduces costs for us and also enables them to do more work in areas where the work is actually needed. At the moment, they are printing in areas that are causing us to do a lot more work that doesn't add a lot of value. So we're looking at automation, but beyond just our own little isolated area as the post office. We're looking at automation at a value chain level, and therefore we leverage capital expenditure at those levels as well.
Thank you, Doctor. There was a question around unfair competition. I think from where we stand as the post office, we believe very strongly that there was regulation put in place. There is a law in place that protects a certain weight, size, and dimension of parcels and letters. And that particular protection was designed to provide for our capacity to then roll out USO, etc., etc. And we also view that a number of private entities have, in fact, entered into this market and they deprived us of that income. And hence, in some ways, we find ourselves sitting here explaining how we get ourselves out of a hole. But the important thing, I think, is that we need to acknowledge that these practices do go on. We don't need new regulations to enforce this. The regulations actually exist. We just need to find a means of ensuring that enforcement does happen. And these are the discussions that are currently undergoing right now with ICASA and the DDPS on how do we enforce these regulations. And this is true even from, just to expand a little bit, even from a government perspective, when we talk about a 30% increase in government business, part of that involves that portion of government business that is currently going to other players in the market that should, by legislation, actually be going to the post office. Let's see what else, number two. there was a question by Honorable Siwela about why do we put 0 hours? Is that not too ambitious? Again, I reiterate, a lot of what we have put is ambitious, there's no question about it, but it is also necessary. If we are to get the post office to the level where it's meant to be, we have to put targets that are necessary. And so you find, for example, from an HCM point of view, we have said we would like it as an organization not to have any labor unrest. So the 0 hours are related to those type of lost hours. It's not lost hours, for example, someone didn't come to work or anything like that. It's talking to lost hours to labor unrest. So ideally, we would like to have a stable labor environment where there is robust engagement with our labor unions, there is trust built with our labor unions, such that the labor forums that are supposed to be operational in the post office do so operate in such a manner that, in fact, we will not have lost hours due to labor unrest. So that's what we are referring to.
Just in terms of that, what we've also done is that we started talking to the unions about a different type of agreement that basically looks at a multi-year agreement, because that creates a bit more stability. But then also in terms of reconstituting the forums at the different levels, currently two of the unions have actually agreed to our new proposal, and we're busy negotiating with the third union around that, and we're actually meeting with them tomorrow. And from my initial discussions with them, they've actually indicated that there's just a few small things that they have a problem with, but the overall consensus around having local level agreements at local level negotiating forums and consultative forums at all the different levels should be put back in place. So a lot of work has already gone into that space, and we're very comfortable that we can actually get that one in bed.
Thank you very much.
And there's also an issue of, do we think labor will lie low when we do retrenchments and not react to that? No, we don't think so. But we have also Chairperson in the STP plan included comments from labor itself. And you will see when you read that commentary, they actually are agreeable largely to things like early retirement in terms of exit plans. What they are opposed to is forced retrenchments. Our view is we're very far from getting into that, and we think we will have enough mitigation both at an entrepreneurial and employment levels to deal with that. But we are going to start with voluntary exits, we're going to start with early retirement offerings, which is things that they also agree to and say we must get going with. And also when you read the comments from the employees, they themselves are asking for that.
Thank you very much. Honorable Shin, where is DDT income? It's most definitely in there. We have not lost it. We solely require it. It is certainly in there, but you will recall that DDT actually predates the STD and the administration, etc. So we've just captured it in the financials as part of the income that will be coming through. Sorry? Yeah?
Andrew Fakurende. If you go to page 5 on the corporate plan document, the acting group CEO has indicated in the summary there, the second project yesterday is the DDT. The corporate plan, Honourable Member. Page 5 of the corporate plan, the strategic corporate plan document. Page 5 of the strategic corporate plan, the acting GCL's report indicates in bullet 2 there's a rollout of the DCT. It highlighted there as one of these key projects, but we've definitely included the numbers in the financials.
I think the matter more is that within the financial statement, because that is money that is appropriated to post office. But it's appropriated, Honorable Shin, remember, it's appropriated via, it's very funny how it's been appropriated. It's not directly appropriated to the SAPO. In terms of the appropriation, it's via USASA. So it's still currently sitting as we approve the budget. We are approving it as it's sitting on USASA, not directly at SAPO. So I understood it when I didn't see it. I remember that because that amount, that's why if you remember during the presentation of USASA, they had to have some page where they explained that, I think it's 180 million or something, a particular bound is for project management, but another one is for distribution that goes to SAPO. So, but I think where it didn't come across, with the finances, I think it's quite correct that they should have put it because the money is not directed to them. But once it's transferred, they've got to, I think the DTP will have to assist us in how it's going to be done and how it's managed. I think maybe we could have done an oversight when we were dealing with DTPs. And you start to ask how it's going to be accounted for from post office. But what I expected from post office in terms of their plan itself is the program to come out strongly. I think that's what I'm hoping. I think let's note it when we have the discussion even on the report. It's something that we might need to come back to. Jim, you want to say?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I had actually wanted to talk to that because I'm sure honourable members will understand that with the digital migration process, there are opportunities for other agencies to work in an integrated and coordinated manner. And the post office has consistently expressed interest in being a distributor of a set of top boxes. So from that point of view, it's really a business that they will, the opportunity that they are waiting for, and that's when then you will begin to see that as a revenue. But they wouldn't put it at this point, as the chairperson was saying. No. The issue is that on the letter that was from Treasury to USASA, the letter has said to USASA that the money, because USASA had budgeted for the whole amount for their project management. So the money said it's for distribution. I think what we need to ascertain from USASA and assist post office is to close that gap, because our understanding is that through the planning over years has been that post office will be distribution. With the current, and I hear what you're saying, that the matter might not have been finalized, and so the money is not yet reflected on post office. It's something that must just be clarified properly, and I don't think post office will be in the process. I'm not sure if I'm assisting or confusing members well. DMM confusing everybody was. The DDG would like to explain that one further. I don't know whether you want him to do that.
As I said, when the post office was before us in March, we were told that they had budgeted for an income of 929 million over 3 years for the distribution of set-top boxes. How do you expect that projected income to be visible somewhere in their projected bailout, if you like, their projected return to financial stability? So am I assuming that this miraculous turnaround is going to happen in a year excludes, because it's not in here, the funding likely to come, hopefully to come, from the distribution of set-top boxes?
Can I try and assist at all? Because I think it is there, we just don't talk to each of the projects. But if you look at our logistics government business in the particular slide, which is in the additional text that says the supporting notes, that's the breakdown of the 4 billion that we showed in the bar in the other slide. Those 352s, they actually include that money. If you look at the logistics part, capture additional government business logistics. That 352, 807 and 856 includes that. I just want to highlight, we have a team that's working with USASA, coordinated by DCPS. We've recently been asked to sharpen our pens. We've looked again at how we will do that distribution, utilizing more of our infrastructure, and we've reduced the 922 to 836. So then the figure going forward that you'll hear us talking about is 836 over the period of the rollout, but it's in that logistics line.
Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Just to clarify the issue of USAFA and SAPO. There is an agreement that USAFA will play a role in the distribution of set-top boxes. But what has happened right now is the money has, as the chairperson has indicated, an amount of about 190 million has been appropriated to USAFA. Of that amount, about 31 million is going to be used by USAFA for their ERP system. And the remaining amount is going to be used for distribution of set-top boxes. Now, the money is in the name of USAFA, but as the post office then distributes the set-top boxes, it will then be paid on the basis of the set-top boxes that it distributes by USAFA. Thank you, Chairperson.
Do you want to say something?
No, I'm happy with the explanation because basically I thought it's simply mathematics that you pay as you deliver the service. Thank you, TTG. You know, there was just something small, Chairperson, which I thought one needs to go back to it. I don't know whether it came from Honorable Mackenzie. I'm looking at my notes now because I'm also writing. This question of the uncompetitive behavior, maybe one really has to revisit what we have been saying about this presentation, that it takes us back to the value of the NDP, the vision in the NDP. I think we'll be missing a point if we don't locate whatever we say within a service to the most vulnerable groups in South Africa. Because if we miss that point, that's why we will start sometimes having difficulties in understanding the interventions that are being proposed in terms of their value as far as the inclusion agenda is concerned. So I think in all fairness, we have to locate the post office within that. And also even compare with studies done in other parts of the world, like the UK and so on. People have come out to affirm the post office and specifically made reference to rural communities, made reference to small businesses, the question of small parcels and packets that people who do business from home, people who do business online, they rely on the post office. And I think whenever we think about government intervention, be it cash injections, it's really in the context of those obligations that we have in terms of the developmental agenda. I thought it's important to emphasize that point. And the question of the question, you know, this question of a trusted brand and a wide network is something which we somehow we should constantly bring to the fore when it comes to the value of the post office. And I don't know from management how are they gonna help us with the smart partnerships that the NDP talks to, particularly around the post office. Because again, we emphasize the poorest of the poor, but at the same time, it also talks to the value that the private sector should appreciate with the post office, given its footprint. We should come up clearly as to how we leverage from this footprint, because even big businesses in big cities, they still want to reach out to the whole country. They don't want to do business only in big cities, the golden cities. And the post office, as a reliable brand, has a tremendous value when it comes to that as well. I just wanted to make those few points.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to give the finance team a quick opportunity to respond to some of the issues around the finances before I continue again. Thank you.
I think the question that was posed was regarding the state guarantee on the 270 and the 167. in December 2015, there was a state guarantee issued already to back the 2014, to back the existing overdraft facility, just to give comfort to the bankers. Also, for the purposes of concluding on the financial statements for the prior financial year, there was still another guarantee, paper guarantee of 1.67 that's made reference here. What has been further elaborated is that the post office is able to borrow on the back of that guarantee, and that is the logic that we talk about there. So that 1.25 billion borrowing will be, we've lodged an application to borrow against the guarantee.
Nothing, and also Honourable Chairperson had a question around whether the cost of that funding is included. And yes, it's indeed in that net interest line that you saw in the waterfall stack chart. That's all interest on overdraft as well as additional term lending and the bridging finance. I think one thing just come to notice, I have to mention also that we borrowed 200 million from Standard Bank just as a short-term bridging finance, so that 200 million will be repaid by part of the 1.25 billion. So in total, the debt on the balance sheet will end up at being 1520. Yes, that 16 was the net interest, but there's also interest received in there as well, but the net effect, we have the detailed numbers down it if you want to see those.
The financial explanations are asked, page, I think it's 45, on the corporate plan, 45.
Okay, all right. The subsidy unutilized at the end of 2013-2014. Indeed, yes, there was an unutilized subsidy, and that related to useful obligations, and that has subsequently been utilized in the 2014-2015 year. And
you say it's utilized.
Utilized.
But it's not reflected. It is reflected where?
The zero. Should the balance sheet moves from... if you also look on page 44, you will see the utilization under the red. You will see that there's an 85305 that's now utilized under the 2014-2015 year. And also the inquiries around unearned revenue and provisions. SAPO operates on IFRS accrual system. So unearned revenue would relate to accounting smoothing of income received in advance. For example, if there's income received for post boxes, then we would, in the appropriate year, carry the 3 months worth of the post box revenue. And then on the balance sheet closure, when we close the year, then the carry forward, we then recognize it as an unearned revenue. So that's just to give detail to what the unearned revenue line is. And provisions, that's mainly also provisions for leave, mainly. And there will also be provisions for IFRS accounting for leave provisions when you're doing leave smoothing in accordance with IFRS. Page 46. Oh, the CAPEX. The CAPEX, where we speak to depending on availability of funds. The CAPEX for Postbank, that's not dependent on availability of funds. That CAPEX budget is already ring-fenced in the CPD funds. And the CAPEX on the SAPO side of 707, that will purely depend on the funds generated by the strategic turnaround. There will be key projects that will be prioritized in order to unlock the turnaround plan. And as funds avail, by that I mean there will not be additional funding that will be raised. It will be on the back of cash that's generated where additional CAPEX budgets will be allocated.
Replacement question. Why not the CAPEX?
Need to deal with it mainly on IT infrastructure and also on the processing, mail processing.
One of the things is that we don't have CAPEX reported as, you have money reported as CAPEX, whereas it's operational money. One should be sure. But it's difficult for CAPEX, because at times you find entities, there is no capital. When you go back, you find that it's money that is supposed to be reported under operational. So I'm just trying to be sure that all of us are on the same page. This is CAPEX. And the other thing is capital, IT infrastructure and operation. What is it?
IT infrastructure and on mail processing capital expenditure.
So that is recorded in our report. And then there was deferred tax and depreciation, page 48 and 49.
Okay. The deferred tax is usually on timing differences. That's also where your accounting and your income tax act differ, and then you will have your deferred tax, either deferred tax asset or deferred tax liability that you would carry on your balance sheet.
Chairperson, the deferred tax asset, I think, relates to the tax benefit on assessed losses that's been run up in CSG and in SAPO, and then the deferred tax liability would be the difference in depreciation as per accounting and wear and tear allowance as per tax. So it's basically a tax that will get paid in future, but normally it won't, because you keep on replenishing your, as you depreciate your assets, you keep on replenishing your assets. Deferred tax asset. Deferred tax is one of the most difficult subjects in accounting. Not simple. But it's an accounting issue. It's purely an accounting issue.
Let's get clarity. You're saying, let's explain this. Let's leave depreciation for now. We explain the deferred tax. We've got to approve every line item here. We can't approve something we're not so sure about.
The deferred tax asset is mainly because of the carryover asset losses, which will be utilized in future. The deferred tax liability, remember this is consolidated statements. There are entities within SAPO that are profit making, like Dockets. So there where you have deferred tax liabilities, where you have timing differences on your wear and tear and your depreciation, as an example, or provision for leave and like, then that's how the deferred tax liability will arise. Yes, you will have different line items where you have an asset and a liability, because we don't have a net set of ability. Every entity within the organization pays their own tax, so you will see it on both the asset and the liability.
I think I'm going to need an independent opinion on this. Okay. Depreciation? Yeah, no, I really need an independent opinion on this. Let me tell you why we are very sensitive about this thing. Previously, SAPO used to declare a profit on a what is it, substitute. And it passes when you don't ask those questions and you're not clear about something. So for me, each line item, until I understand what it means, I'm not comfortable. Because the fact that you have a record, I'm sorry, some of you are not there, but the fact that you have a record of declaring a subsidy, an income, or a profit, for me, it's just something that I get worried about. That's why I would want an independent opinion. Just to say, is this an acceptable thing? Why would you have a deferred tax? Let's get the explanation on the depreciation.
I'll take that one. FirstBank is, in the next year, implementing a significant amount of IT systems, enterprise risk management, enterprise resource planning, etc., to meet the requirements of the Banks Act. So in this year, our CapEx goes up, and then when the assets are put into use, in the following financial year, we have to start depreciating them. Okay, I stand corrected. This is where we owe SAPO every month for the support costs and the transfer pricing, and you know, we get them at the end of the month and then you settle in cash next day. So it's just the month end balance. And it's settled each month in cash. And sometimes earlier.
It's a company liability, really. It shouldn't really be a loan.
I think, colleagues, it's very important that the language and it's what we can understand. Remember, when you submit a document, it's a public document, it's read by everybody in the public. We have an opportunity to ask you those questions, and our report needs to reflect exactly. So that if somebody picks up something that is not making sense, they can go to our report and find some of these explanations. That's why, and it's important to write things. That's why initially when I started speaking around your finances, I said, normally when you read annual reports, there's explanatory notes on things that are not normal compared to other companies. So when you have something like this, at least a footnote or an explanatory note that says, this is what is it, will help. I hope in future we'll take that and make sure that we reflect that way, so that this abnormalities, but as well to give us comfort as the committee that we're not approving things that are not really, okay. Because that's why I was starting to say intercompany loan. Why would you loan within? Is it within the legal framework? Is it legal what you're doing? Because there's been an allegation, Andrew Longo would know. There was at some point last year an allegation that the CFO took money to pay salaries from funding software accounts and all those things. So that's what I'm saying to you. For us, we might be sitting here, you think it's just a legal question. It's based on the experience of dealing with SAP. That we fought with her and get the details in what is here in front of us. So I thought, let me just clarify that, and then let's get other responses that are suspended.
Thank you, Chairperson. And we do note that, and we'll make sure that in future there's additional notes added to the report. To go back to some of the questions, there was a question about how are we going to take staff along. I think the administrator has alluded to the fact that there's already been extensive engagement with staff members, not just through unions, but individual staff. And at the point at which we have finalization in terms of signing us, we have a project in the post office waiting to launch now that we'll start talking to internal employees about the impact of the strategic turnaround plan, the role in the strategic turnaround plan, the key objectives of that plan, and where we intend to go with it. So there certainly will be a massive program to engage workers in terms of just making clear what their role will be in terms of the turnaround plan itself.
And if I can just come in there.
Sure.
Just in terms of change management, we've actually piloted within the human capital and the strategy teams the program that looks at the change management. And it's definitely not a question of lumping or liking it. It's a question of let's see how we can engage people with regard to the change management. It's also not one of those change management plans that is based on a lot of models. It's very simplified, and it addresses the issue around me as an individual. How do I feel at this current state within the post office? And it addresses the issues around what has happened in the last year, around the impact of the strike on the individual, as well as the impact on the strike on teams. And then the question or the issue that I raised around the employee value proposition. The next level that it looks at is in terms of constantly contextualizing this journey and the communication that Andrew referred to. But then also it looks at the creating a high-performance team and culture. And it looks specifically around when we populate the structure, we try to move away from all of these people that are acting and to look at accountability specifically within the organization. So it focuses a lot on the performance management to enable high-performance culture and an improvement in how we do things. Then also in terms of leadership's role, in role modeling, what the right behavior should be. So it is very crucial for us that we get the right people in. And there was a question earlier in terms of do we have the credible institutions or the credible recruitment processes. And one of the key things that we're looking at is specifically that. Obviously, you can understand where we are with regard to our funding. There's also another tightrope that we're walking in terms of
So what we're trying to do right now is to buy the correct skill at the correct price. Because obviously you can imagine that the best skill would be very expensive within the post office. So we need to walk a middle path in terms of getting the appropriate skill within the organization to enable the strategic transformation plan, but also not the most expensive skill. And that is something that we constantly focusing on in terms of managing our employee costs, at the same time getting the best skills that we can possibly get out of it.
Thank you very much. The question on crime prevention plan, there certainly are detailed plans around the crime prevention plan, and they are across the full scope of the operations of the post office. So it's not just focused purely on post bank, for example. It's around things like parcel management, ensuring that we meet our obligations from an international perspective around the safety of parcels, the non-pilferage of parcels, etc. So it will cover all of that, and there are certainly detailed plans to that. The post office has had both the ECS and ECNS license for a while now. This came about as a consequence of the fact that we possessed the VANS license in the previous dispensation. We have not used them effectively in the past, but in the STP, you will notice we had mobile virtual network operator there. Part of that is what we'll be using the licenses for, to try and generate income as the post office. So in future, you will start to see hopefully an alliance come through on those licenses.
Can we allow Mutatsi to talk to that?
Not a problem.
No, thank you, Chairman and members, honorable members. If you look at that slice of initiatives, the third one is really on the screen. It's ICT hotspots. This is creating communities in rural areas specifically where there are no services and there are no outlets, of a hotspot where you would have a full integrated system where a member of the community would come in, fax, copy, email, have a live mailbox, and be able to email and receive mail inside the post office with a full community. Part of the infrastructure on the capital side that goes is to link those particular networks in a rural area through a radio telecommunication. The next slide is a mobile virtual network operator, which effectively uses the ECS type of the license to sell, in partnership with the likes of Telkom, the full bouquet as a post office customer towards the rural areas specifically as well. And there are a number of those initiatives set down the land as a retail hotspot and ICT retail hub inside the rural and semi-rural post office as well. So there are a number of those initiatives that are ECS, ECNS type new generation revenues that are aimed for the post office.
Thank you very much, Marcus. There was also a question around USO and point of presence, and whether we should not be considering sharing space with other government departments, etc. I think members will be aware that in the past there was a concept called the Tucson Center, and that concept was primarily exactly that, to try and get all government-related service provision agencies to be seated in one place so that people in rural areas don't have to travel X number of kilometers from one place to another. You just come to one building. And at the post office, we are not averse to this. I think one of the things we have consistently said within the context of the national ICT policy debate, for example, is that we continue to want to position ourselves as the effective arm of government and government service delivery in those remote areas. So we would happily go with the concept that you can use whatever space we have as a post office to house any other service delivery arm of government that requires that space.
Questions?
Yes, I'm just trying to cover the last. No, I think the rest were comments. Yes, so thank you very much.
Members, I'm not sure if there's anyone who's got a pressing follow up. Just two. Okay, I'll give you Honourable Killian. Can I give you 1 minute each? I'm battling with the meeting today. Honourable McKenna. There's only one me. Yes.
So much on the post office, I'm overwhelmed.
Sorry, Chairperson, it's been so long since we've seen the post office. I have so much to ask that I find it hard to contain myself. Let me be dramatic. You know my style is dramatic, Chairperson. Let me be dramatic. When to get back to this point of turning it around from a 1.2 billion to a loss to a 1.3 billion profit in 2 years, I had occasion to visit the Boksburg post office yesterday. Chairperson, my experience was less than I don't know if you can see these.
I can see, you see that thing.
Look there. That's the cash lane. I'm going to show it to you afterwards. That's the cash lane. You know, spray painted across the way. This is the customer experience when they come to the post office in the CBD of Boksburg. So when we talk about customer centric, when we talk, and it's grand, this vision of yours, the plan, Dr. Lushaba, you and your team for producing this document, it's the best thing, I agree with the chairperson, the best thing we've seen in the committee is this plan. It really is solid and it's sound. Sir, when I hear you talking about the things that you're going to introduce in the retail center, it's grand. When I walked into the post office yesterday, in the Boksburg post office, there were three queues. The queue marshal was a security guard who was employed by an external company. So he wasn't even a post office employee. He was directing people to the queues. There were two counters open for parcels and mail and one for renewing vehicle licenses, you know, the license discs. And the people were sitting waiting to be renewed. I finally got to the counter, and I do this from time to time. I call it my own personal follow the mail. I send myself letters to see how long it takes to get to where I'm going. Nobody else writes to me. I send myself letters. And I wanted to send the speed services, because for me, speed services is a great service that you offer. Those sturdy plastic envelopes, even a bull terrier couldn't rip them open, you know, and it goes counter to counter, and it's done. I went to the counter, and I said, can I have a speed service on it? He didn't have any speed service envelopes. He said, can you go and wrap this in some brown or white paper? Now, that was my customer-centric experience at Boksburg Post Office in the CBD of Boksburg. Where the post boxes are, there's urine everywhere. The homeless people come in and sleep there at night. I went to speak to the man behind the counter who sort of looks after the boxes, and he said to me, well, it's not really my job, but sometimes on a Friday I get a broom and I come and sleep. I asked the postmaster, do you have any security at this thing? No, there's no security at night. The light fittings are broken. And it's a post bank branch. It's a bank. And you look at them, the dusty windows, the dirty windows, the moles, the ants. I mean, it's just that is the customer-centric experience of the post office. And it's completely out of reality with us. So when you talk about a two-year turnaround, I find it very, very hard to believe. I think you need to get back to basics, Dr. Lushaba, with respect, sir. That broken window policy, you know, the one broken window, fix the broken windows, get the basics, and Mr. Pravin Gordhan talks about that with municipalities. Go back to the basics of your business, core of your business, and fix that, because you don't have the staff, with respect, you don't have the staff to do that in the rural locations, to come and train people and assist people and get people going on those things. You don't have it. Get back to basics, fix the broken windows, clean the dirty post offices, get the people in uniforms to get post office people to look after customers. I think then we can start to go further than that. But really, that would be my general advice. Just get back to basics, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, for letting me vent.
Obviously, I also have concerns about meeting this turnaround target, particularly as it depends a lot on these cost reduction issues that you have here, like, you know, workforce resizing or right sizing. Now, that's going to cost close to 2 billion rand over 3 years, just if I understand. You're going to save 2 billion rand over 3 years. I'm looking at, what is this? STP business case detail on page 11. You've got cost reduction, workforce right sizing. in the current financial year, 517 million, is it, that you're going to save this year on workforce right-sizing. And then, but over the 3 years, it's going to come to 2 billion rand worth of savings through right-sizing. In addition to, now depending on which report you read, 13 million rand on terminating the casuals. So 26 million over 2 years for terminating the casuals. But yet on the document I've got at the end of last week, this is going to cost 8 million rand. So it's got, you know, quite a lot just over the weekend. Labor Day has something to do with that, I think, May Day or whatever it was. So, but what I'm, the question I really want to ask is, how certain are you that you'll be able to cut all those costs within a year to turn this around? I mean, I don't believe you're going to be able to retrench 5,000 people or early retire them in a year. I mean, is that feasible? Is that really feasible? And you're doing all sorts of other things as well, the main one of which is the workforce right-sizing. I have doubts that your cost-cutting is actually going to deliver the results that you project. There's too much human factor in this.
She goes, and I wish I could be so dramatic as Honourable Mackenzie, but yes, Honourable Schiller said it, we only need one prima donna here. Can I just ask, you asked the question, I don't want to hijack your question, and maybe I lost my focus for a moment, but the subsidiary boards on page 58, we know that CFG and can you please have an explanation of what is expected in future? Are you going to reconfigure the structure, the group structure? Because we don't understand why there are so many subsidiary boards, and also the issue of the property companies. Apparently there are several. So is that not necessarily going to be restructured as well? Can we please understand what the function is of those companies?
Sure, we didn't answer that question, but there is an answer to that. Yes, the turnaround plan creates a staple partners business, and therefore we do away with the different companies in logistics, which is CFG, DocEx. We are focusing on fixing the ones that need to be fixed, like CFG, get rid of the unprofitable business, because we don't want to combine bad with bad and hope for good. So we rather fix it where it is, focus on it, and then amalgamate it. The property companies...
Which one are you fixing?
CFG.
The one that has been making losses since 2013?
Yes, yes. That's the one, for instance, where I said we are stopping the PX business. We're doing away with PX because you could see on the graph that I showed you that all their products are loss-making. We've offered their clients, for instance, profitable alternatives. So that as we amalgamate that business into SAPO, it should be, into SAPO Logistics, it should be profitable. So we're actually just dealing with it in stages. But
the energy... I got confused. I thought that you're still keeping it to the subsidiary.
No.
That's why I come to the way I can.
My apologies, Chair. The thing is that it has creditors, it has other stakeholders, so we can't just like switch off the lines and it creates more havoc. So we try to deal with it systemically. The property companies that you are referring to, what they had done in the past, they took all the critical properties, mainly the mail centers, and they ring-fenced them, and they did that to protect them, so that if SAPO is attacked for whatever reason, those critical properties for operations are not subject to that. So you'll find Cape Mail, I think Vestport, but it's just a shell holding, and one thing you'll assist in that, but that's my understanding. But it's something that companies do to to protect the critical assets of delivery, because if somebody attached things at SAPO, and I'm still going to talk to the surprises as well that you asked about, but if somebody attacks SAPO for whatever reason, you don't want to stagnate critical. So since those will be separate companies, you would still retain them, you still be able to operate them. That's basically what they've done here. Surprises. You want a surprise? look, it's a very difficult issue because you do get from time to time letters. I don't want to talk about this in detail because we're still taking it back to court. Actually, today we lodged papers to take it back to court because we believe that there is a serious oversight in terms of compliance with PFMA. Unfortunately, though, this has taken so long, so judges are taking a very hard point in terms of saying, while you raising new defenses, you had enough opportunity to raise those, but I wasn't there. So I am trying as best as I can to defend public funds so that they are not wasted, but we could lose. Unfortunately, we do think that we do have to take this on in up with different players in the process over a period of time. It is unclear to us why we never argued to the PFMA defense, because it was supposed to be some kind of a joint venture. This is signed by people whose authority did not allow them to sign it. So there's a whole host of issues that are muddled into it, but I would rather leave that to the courts to decide. I don't know if there are other surprises. This was a real surprise for me. After the court made a decision, I had not known about it. I've tried to say SAPO, let us look. But some of those issues are not in court yet. However, there are some that are being handled through the SIU process, like the EcoPoint specifically that you talked about. My understanding is that they are making progress, and we're looking forward to a day that they'll conclude their report, and we will know what to do with that.
Court. I think our view would be, should SAPO lose money, would you expect SAPO to go and recover the money from the individuals who have signed, knowing very well that they're not supposed to sign? That's all. I think it should be clear. That's our position. Like, if it happens that SAPO loses the money in court, that 50 million, it must be recovered from those individuals. I don't know, GM, do you have some comments? So that we can...
There was just one question about cabinet decision on the 30% business. You know, the Lekgotla made a decision, the cabinet Lekgotla made a decision, and the cabinet memo will come out of this process we are in. Once the parliament has approved everything, then obviously we'll then develop a cap memo. But what is good with the cabinet, the whole decision, is that it's an interdepartmental effort where everybody was saying, how do we contribute towards the renewal of the mandate of the post office? There were commitments from everybody that at least for a start, we should all ensure that 30% of our goods are delivered through the post office. The other one was the question of credibility of board members. Honorable members, you will know that's the most difficult aspect, because most board members are recruited on those bases. The criteria for SOEs is not different from the one used by the private sector. Competences, skills, of sound mind, all the important, the high-level values that we attach to people who will to from. Chairperson, we need your protection. So there is a process in place, an advert, it has been an open process, was sent out. There's a due process where the teams from both the post office and the relevant oversight department are assisting us. We are really, actually we tried twice to open the advert to get credible people, and we're hoping that what the ultimate outcome will be suitable and appropriate for the cause, the renewal of the mandate of the post office, or the post office for the future. Thank you very much.
And maybe let me just add that on the post bank side, we are having the nominated members of the bank that would corporatize the entity being vetted by Deloitte. That's also a requirement of the South African Reserve Bank that they have to be vetted by an independent audit firm, and that list will then go to SARB to be approved, and then the minister can appoint out of those approved individuals. That step is actually probably the one that is in the critical path. We have done the asset split, and the minister has actually approved that, and the Post Bank also has done the forecast, the 3 to 5 year forecast. All of those will be submitted with the board members to the SARB, and that completes Section 12, which actually is the most important next milestone. So we've worked very hard over the past few months to drive that particular process. Those are the 3 steps that complete the Section 12 application. After that, once you grant the Section 12 application, which is the first step in the corporatization process, you then give in a year to do your Section 14 to Section 16 of the corporatization process. And that's also a Bank Act requirement. So there's nothing we can do with that 12 months, but we have to complete all of what needs to be done in the 12 months. Otherwise, the Reserve Bank might ask us to start from scratch, which would be unbearable. So that's basically where we are with the corporatization process. And it's a question of those going through now.
Thank you very much, colleagues and members. I think we've really had a long discussion. I know Honourable McKenzie would want to still have more and more discussion. But I think our time was until 5 o'clock. It's already 5 past 5. Just to alert members before I close is that you know that in the previous meeting there was a request to the department to submit a letter to the committee by the Tuesday. The DG requested an extension till Thursday. The letter has not been submitted as we speak. I don't have it with me. So I thought I should alert you. On the issue of CITAM, CITAM has done their corporate plan together with their annual performance plan. They just received signing off from the minister because this is the process. I've just asked them to, they're trying to get the copies through to us between tomorrow, hopefully by tomorrow. You should get those copies. So it means they're going to retain it, replacing what we had. So I'm just appealing to members to go through that. I doubt in light of the time that we have, because it's EPCs already members, and for us to sit, we've got to apply for any time, and currently the application process is just a bit tedious, and it might be a bit too much for us to be able to have 2 meetings. So we literally have 1 meeting before the budget vote debate. That's where the difficulty is, and now with that in mind, the documents are going to be distributed. I'm just appealing to members to go through them so that when we do the discussion next Tuesday, we obviously have to start, we would not have the entity here. But it's more for us to look at the differences. I'll get an indication if there's huge issues that we need to call them in to find a way of doing. But we are expected to adopt our report on Tuesday next week. It's a difficult situation we find ourselves in. And unfortunately, I have to submit the report tightly being adopted to the House Chairperson to see that we have complied with the legislation and the processes of Parliament before it is adopted. So with those time frames that are difficult and all that, it's just proving it's difficult to reschedule a meeting specifically with CETA. So I would ask the team that is working on the report as well to look at where, because remember we had already raised issues. So what CETA was going to do is to adjust based on our comments what they need to correct and correct those and make it professional, their strategic plan from those errors, sources not being found and all those things that were there. So I'm hoping, members, that there's nothing that warrants us to have to interact with them. But if any member picks it up, please do indicate if there's changes in terms of the financial statements, because that would warrant for us to most of them. That would be something that we'd have to deal with. But I'm just hoping that there isn't a need really. It was a matter of realignment and cleaning up of the documents that does not warrant, and therefore we can be able to at least deal with our documents next Tuesday. What we do, I've put some time frames to the team. I'm hoping that we should be able to get the documents through to you by Thursday to all members. I'm going to request members to go through the documents and at least send some of the comments electronically so that they can start being incorporated. So that when we meet on Tuesday, your comments and your corrections have been incorporated. So it might be a waiting weekend for all of us, if feasible. We always, like I know, members over the weekend, when I'm on McKenzie and I sometimes exchange emails around 11 o'clock at night. So I know that he has a long day, so he should be able to assist. I'm just appealing members that for this process, can we try? I know it's going to be unreasonable time frames. I would want to see a situation whereby the team is able to, by Monday, send you back the final document that they have been able to incorporate the comments, so that when you come on Tuesday, you are carrying the document that is incorporated with your comments. So I'm highlighting the time pressure that you've got to be able to look at the documents and go through.
Chairperson Banjiri, it's a very important event, but 133 is the Democratic Alliance as a federal congress where we sometimes elect new national leaders, and that's happening this weekend. But it's not, it's just lots of partying and friendly games. You know, unlike some other parties, we don't bring our pangas to the meetings. We generally have a good time. But the thing is, we will be leaving on Thursday afternoon, the precinct, so if we can maybe get the document before midday, and that would assist. Thank you, Chairperson.
We'll definitely make sure that you get it. Okay, I'll definitely make sure that you get a document. That's why I was highlighting to the department and to the entities the importance of adhering to the time frames when given, because it just puts pressure on us, and sometimes it's really unfair. So, unfortunately, without any comments on BVI, we'll have to take a decision as a committee on what do we do to save BVI outside the department. Thank you very much, members. The meeting's adjourned.
I'm going to go to the next one. I'm not going to lie.